The briefing is brought to you in association with the Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum at Expo City Dubai is a place for city leaders, developers, architects and designers to come together and innovate for the future of urban spaces. It's an opportunity for the Global South to convene in the Global South. It's a testbed for real-world solutions that will shape the future of people and planet. You can hear from the innovative thinkers and inspirational voices that drove the narrative at this year's edition by listening to Monocle's special episodes of The Briefing, recorded live at Expo City Dubai in March. Find and listen to the shows now at monocle.com or wherever you get your podcasts. The Sustainable Cities in Action Forum 2024. Collaborate, innovate, transform.
You're listening to The Briefing, first broadcast on the 22nd of January 2021 on Monocle 24. The Briefing is brought to you in association with Novartis. Hello and welcome to The Briefing, coming to you live from Monocle's HQ here in Zurich. I'm Tyler Brulé. Coming up, EU leaders discourage travel between member states in a bid to curb the spread of COVID-19. But is the bloc now preparing to close borders? Also ahead on today's program.
We will revitalize American diplomacy to deal with and take on the most pressing challenges of our time. We'll show up again.
We'll be finding out how the nominee for U.S. Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, wants to shake up the country's diplomatic service. Plus, Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis offers us hope that the pandemic may change things for the better.
We went through 10 years of extremely difficult period. Our democracy is stronger now, and our economy, I think, is going to come out stronger as a result of this crisis.
And we'll even have some time for a roundup of the week in culture news. All that right here in The Briefing with me, Tyler Brulé. And good afternoon from rather balmy Zurich for this time of year. We begin today's program in this part of the world where EU leaders have been holding late night talks in a bid to coordinate their response to the spread of coronavirus. Brussels has stopped just short of an outright ban on non-essential travel between member states, but warned that tougher restrictions could come within days if efforts to curb the virus fail. Well, I'm joined on this topic right here in Zurich by Monocle 24's security correspondent, Benno Zog. Benno is also a researcher at the Center for Security Studies at ETH here in Zurich. Good afternoon, Benno.
Good afternoon, Tyler.
Any surprises out of this? But maybe before we get to surprises, maybe just bring us up to speed. What happened amongst all of those Samsung screens that EU leaders had to look at into the wee hours this morning?
Indeed, it was a four-hour online summit, as one does these days, the ninth EU summit, actually, since the pandemic has broken out. And, well, let's say we had a fairly good picture, even beforehand, what they were discuss and what the actual positions of countries are. We've had a number of statements, for example, by the German leadership, Chancellor Merkel, but also her chief of staff, saying that they may be forced to close borders, even though this is a measure they will not really want to take. It should be a drastic measure. There's been Luxembourg's prime minister, probably most outspoken, saying closing the borders in 2020 was a mistake. It would be a mistake to do it now. So these were the positions, hence also no very clear decisions. It's fairly vague at this stage what was decided, that indeed non-essential travel across borders should be restricted, but it's not clear yet to what extent, by what measures, where exactly. Ursula von der Leyen, EU Commission President, only made one thing clear, that at this stage, but that may change, there should not be blanket closure of borders, at least that.
Okay, so what you're saying, the distillation of that is no great surprises. We knew where this is going to go. Now, we've also seen other measures which have, of course, now been adopted by EU member states individually. France announcing off the back of this that they're now going to expect that people will have to have a corona test going into the country. Can't be older than 72 hours. Of course, this is something which almost seems to be coming standard these days. So as much as they want to threaten, and they were talking in the language of, you know, over the next few days, well, we know that this is, they're not going to have a grip on the virus or the spread of it in the next few days. So was this a little bit of, I don't want to say, an exercise in PR to be seen to be doing something? Because the EU stands for Schengen. The EU has built really the foundations of its brand around the notion of open borders.
There is certainly an element of PR in that, understandably so, because we all remember last spring when countries unilaterally, without coordinating even with their very neighbours, closed their borders for, well, sometimes even for essential travels. It was quite strict at times. We all remember that. And now, obviously, the EU is trying to appear that they have learned from that, that they want to coordinate on this. And that's why this summit had the border issue on the agenda so strongly, to actually prevent countries from implementing their measures. But as you just hinted, these national measures are still really important, whether France imposes the requirement to have a negative PCR test for COVID. That actually makes a huge difference for whether Belgians or Luxembourgians or Spanish people cross the border to go grocery shopping or apply for jobs and so on. So we still have these national measures. They have to be national. That also makes sense. It cannot all be EU-wide, but certainly there was a political push to appear like there's coordination. We're only seeing that in the coming few days when all these suggestions that have been made will actually be put into detail. And it all comes down to the detail in the end, how this will be implemented.
How much of this is also an EU start the year HR exercise as well, to rally leaders, to remind them that this is, you know, whatever they're saying, of course, to the press, and whatever they're talking about with fellow ministers back in their own capitals, we have to be coordinated. And at this point, none of you should let it slip, because, listen, we are at a point, we've been talking about this, for the last 2 weeks of this, or 3 weeks of this new year, that sense that there is just an enormous level of fatigue. I mean, I bumped into a regular on the way into the studio today, you know, just now, and just saying, you know, when is this going to end? And now, you know, you start to see, Benno, as well, you know, a newspaper like Blick in Switzerland. Okay, it's a red top, it's a popular paper, but, you know, they lead on, look at everybody in Rio de Janeiro. You know, not great on case numbers in Brazil. Certainly some problems, but everyone's at the beach having a good old time.
That's actually quite interesting, because that's also what we've seen already a year ago. Finger pointing, blaming others, blaming foreigners, blaming people coming in. Hence this border issue. It has so many dimensions to it. Because one could talk about essential workers. For a small country like Luxembourg or Switzerland, it's super important that nurses and doctors from neighbouring countries can come in to work, and that borders remain open for that, and they always were. When it comes to tourism, one can wonder whether these few thousand tourists that may still travel even make a difference to countries' COVID numbers. I think the real game changer has been these mutations, still quite unknown. So actually, a German proposal ahead of the summit was to restrict all UK residents from entering the EU. Oddly, and yet again, this is COVID policy. The UK discusses the same the other way around.
Yeah.
And we've talked about the very same thing a year ago.
So what does this mean in practical terms? Because it also sounds to me like this is the same as so many governments saying we have a work from home policy, whether it's compulsory, whether it's voluntary. I guess, you know, if you're waking up in Finland this morning reading this, or you're waking up in Portugal, you think, okay, well, they really don't want me to go out in the world. I guess there's that also feeling that, yeah, I mean, when it comes, and this we're probably largely talking about even business travel as well, and it's a little bit undefined as to what is essential. This is, as you said, it's all in the details, and I imagine we will hear more. But when it comes to implementation, I think that this is also going to be a bit of a dog's breakfast.
It certainly is really difficult, and it has always been, and it's always been so unsatisfying. That's also why there is so much fatigue, because we have a number of measures in place, and they've been compared to the slices of Swiss cheese measures. That's the logic that's applied. Through one slice of Swiss cheese, there's loads of holes. Things happen. If you put many, many, many next to each other, you may avoid anything slipping through. And that's what these measures are about. So if you take them individually, they may not make sense. They're difficult to implement. They're really hard to make foolproof and bulletproof. And that's why devil's in the detail. And we see exactly that coming through. It's more of the general attitude to not encourage people to travel at all. It isn't really about whether then these last remaining few that are hard-boiled and do whatever they prefer actually do travel, because that does make a difference to the numbers. It's about this general attitude that's supposed to change. That's also what all these political leaders have said yesterday. It was that we really, really, really don't travel But if it's essential for your work, for the health of your family and so on, it should always be allowed. And that's in a way a balance. How that will be implemented in detail, we will see. We will certainly see one thing. I think that's foreseeable. It's some kind of implementation of border zones that may be called red zones or dark red zones. They're probably running out of colours for that, where you need a negative test to cross the border or to even reach a neighbouring town and so on. But these are small, these are local measures, and they are sensible and not too costly. So ideally, there is a focus on that, because in the end, the EU has so many countries as members and within them so many regions with different requirements. So ideally, we have a very federal solution to it. In the end, local problem as well.
Ben Ozog, very good to see you, Monocle security correspondent, joining us here in Zurich, where it's just gone just 10 minutes after 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Now time to head back to London. Daniel Bates is there with the news.
Thank you, Tyler. The Islamic State says it carried out yesterday's suicide attacks in Baghdad. The blast killed at least 32 people and wounded many more. Such attacks have become rare in the Iraqi capital since IS was militarily defeated in the region some 3 years ago. Senate Republicans have asked Democrats to delay the start of Donald Trump's impeachment trial until February. They believe a delay will give the former president time to prepare a defense. Trump stands accused of inciting insurrection. Japan's Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga says he's determined to see the Tokyo Olympics go ahead. Last year's showpiece was postponed with the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, and Japan's opposition parties are now calling on Suga to call off the revised event entirely. And the Monocle Minute reports on a bold new plan for New York's Union Square. The move was unveiled earlier this week and aims to transform the area into a car-free public haven. You can read much more about it by heading over to monocle.com/minute. Those are the day's news headlines. Now back to you, Tyler.
Thank you, Daniel. Now, as the U.S. Senate considers what it should be doing about Donald Trump, the country's new broom, Joe Biden, is wasting no time in setting out what America's domestic and foreign policy will look like over the next 4 years. Key, of course, to how that will be determined and articulated in the U.S. diplomatic service. So what should we expect? Well, I'm joined now by former U.S. diplomat Louis Lukens. Louis' final assignment was deputy chief of mission at the U.S. Embassy in London. He now works as a senior partner at Signum Global Advisors. Good afternoon, Lou.
Good afternoon.
Let's start, I guess, maybe by a little bit of reflection. We could say that certainly Air Force One over the last 4 years was not traveling and crisscrossing international borders, was crisscrossing state borders for sure, but was not clocking up the miles that we're used to seeing under other presidencies. If we were sitting in meetings at state right now, but also at the White House, do you think there's a pretty considered plan in terms of what this first 100 days has to look like? And is a lot of it going to be about big mobilization right away?
Well, there are definitely big plans for the first 100 days, but I would say they're really focused on the domestic situation in America. So I don't think we will see Air Force One crisscrossing the globe anytime in the next couple of months. Joe Biden has to get the coronavirus pandemic under control, and he has to get the economy restarted, I think, before he starts traveling again. I mean, he is somebody who has spent his entire career traveling the globe, and he enjoys it, and he likes it, and he's good at it. But he's going to have to, wait a few months, I think, before he can jump into that role.
Not to speculate how much they have to be fueling up or the aircraft and when, but of course there is this big sense of the world, like, hello, Washington, you've forgotten about us. We haven't been able to roll out the red carpet in so many important capitals and capitals where certainly people would call themselves friends of the United States. So if it's not going to be Air Force One, maybe it's going to be one of the 757s that the State Department uses. Will there then be perhaps a bigger act? Of course, we have to say that Mr. Pompeo in this last stretch, was certainly out in the world. But obviously, the role of course, the new candidate, maybe we can spend a bit of time for those of you who are not, of course, familiar with Mr. Blinken. Maybe a little bit of a quick CV and what we can expect from him, Lou.
Yeah. So, I mean, the good news is that despite the fact that Joe Biden will be stuck at home dealing with domestic issues, he's got a really excellent team coming on board to handle the international relations and the foreign policy and to restore our alliances. Tony Blinken worked for Joe Biden when Joe Biden was a senator on the Foreign Relations Committee. and has been with him pretty much ever since. Was Joe Biden's national security advisor when he was vice president, and then was the deputy secretary of state at the State Department under President Obama during President Obama's second 4 years, and then was with Biden during much of the campaign. So Tony Blinken, you know, Rex Tillerson and Donald Trump had never met before Donald Trump offered him the job of Secretary of State. In this case, Tony Blinken and Joe Biden go back decades. So when Tony Blinken, and he will travel, I think, very quickly to key allies and partners to say, basically, we're back and trust us again, and we're going to work together on key issues. When he meets with those foreign leaders and his counterparts around the world and speaks, he is speaking for the president, and no one will doubt that. They will know that he represents what the president believes.
There's been a lot of discussion about that we'll see bottom-up diplomacy. Now, does that mean really listening to your ambassador who is sitting in Seoul, who is sitting in Canberra, and who's sitting in Ottawa? Is that what we're talking about when we think about bottom-up diplomacy, really getting back and listening to the diplomats again?
Well, that's a piece of it, right? So Donald Trump, you know, he just would wake up in the morning and decide a policy thing and tweet it out and catch everyone by surprise. The way it's supposed to work is that there's a process that does start at the bottom and filters up through the system with different government departments involved, including input from our embassies overseas. And then it gets sort of higher and higher up in the bureaucracy. It goes to the Secretary of State and his counterparts, and then it goes to the White House for a final determination on a policy decision in a meeting led by the National Security Advisor. That process didn't happen over the last 4 years. And the people who are coming in now, who are already in, some of them, are very much process-driven people. They believe in the importance of bringing all the different agencies together and getting the best ideas and making sure everybody is on board and making sure there's no, you know, hidden agendas or hidden secrets, you know, that are going to come back and surprise you. So that's what we're going to see. So it will be a much more bottom-up diplomacy, including, as you noted, with inputs from embassies around the world.
Just finally, before we go, a lot of focus, of course, the moving of furniture, the redecorating or at least retweaking of the Oval Office. This is also a time, though, when, of course, diplomatic residences, when ambassadors' residences around the world will also be going through, well, certainly having a moment where the removal vans will be coming in, because there will be, of course, a change of ambassadors. There will be various appointments. Any view from your side? I mean, having had a post in London, of course, being in the service, you know, are we talking, you know, 5 or 6 key reappointments? How big of a musical chairs will there be at the State Department?
Well, all of Trump's political ambassadors are gone now. They all left this week. So that was roughly 40% of our embassies around the world. So those are all vacant. Those ambassadorships are all vacant right now and waiting to be filled. And, you know, it takes a long time. I mean, he has to identify people. Certainly for jobs like the one in London, there's a lot of jockeying for that job. A lot of people would like to come here as ambassador. And then the process itself, the financial disclosures, the background checks, I mean, all that takes a while. So the soonest we would see ambassadors heading out from Washington to posts around the world, I think, would be sometime mid to late summer. But yeah, there are a lot of embassies right now that where the political ambassadors are gone, but the career diplomats who've been the number two are now running the embassies.
Very good. Well, Louis Lucas, we'll be looking forward to hearing more about what happens at the State Department, also at U.S. posts around the world. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24.
Novartis is proud to partner The Briefing on Monocle 24. Novartis is a company that is committed to reimagining medicine. The global healthcare leader intent on changing the practice of medicine, Novartis has been exploring uncharted frontiers in science for more than a century. Today, the company is working on breakthrough treatments that push the boundaries of human understanding in biology, data science, and engineering to develop and deliver therapies that help people live longer and healthier lives around the world. Novartis, reimagining medicine.
You are back with The Briefing with me, Tyler Brulé, just 13, 19 here in Zurich. Well, Monocle's February issue is out now, and tucked inside is a sit-down interview with Greece's progressive Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis. At the end of last year, Monocle's editor-in-chief, Andrew Tuck, and I took a flight to Athens to meet him, and after picking up some good Greek wine along the way, we asked Mr. Mitsotakis how Greece is rebuilding its national confidence.
Well, we are in the process of developing a very ambitious rebranding strategy for the country, which will go in line with where we want to take the country. And of course, this needs to be reflected in our brand, in the aesthetics, but also in the messaging and in the stories that we tell, because maybe just a brand is an aggregation of the sort of surprising stories that emerge out of Greece that many people would not necessarily anticipate coming from a country such as Greece. You know, we focus a lot on our glorious past, and certainly we have a lot to talk about on that front, but there's a very promising future ahead of us, and that's the sort of path that we need to charter. But you spoke about a bottle of wine. We have fantastic agricultural products. The one thing that distinguishes Greece should always be quality, and the fact that every product can tell a local story. So if you just look at the progress that our agricultural products have made, we're never going to be a mass producer. Maybe we can be a mass producer in olive oil, but even there we can do more to brand and to make sure that we capture a bigger chunk of the value added. You know that sort of remarkable that the biggest chunk of our olive oil is actually exported in bulk to Italy and then rebranded or, you know, mixed with Italian oil. And I want to change that. We need to be able to capture the value of the Greek products. And this is already beginning to happen. If you look at our wine industry, it is really booming. And we have exceptional wines that receive raving reviews and new, completely new varieties. And I don't want to compete with the French on Cabernet Sauvignon. No. But I want to focus on Xinomavro or Mavrotragano, which are probably varieties you never heard of, but people who have it are absolutely thrilled because they are Greek and they're very original and they tell a story. And if you combine it with travel off the beaten track, then you can really tell a very compelling story. For example, Santorini is known for its beautiful sunset, but it also produces exceptional wines.
You'll be happy to hear that on the way here, we stopped at Oak Cellars and filled up the back of the car with nice wines from Santorini.
Good. Well, I can make some suggestions. But also, there's also another aspect which, of course, I'm slightly biased because this has also to do with what my wife at least is or was doing professionally, and that has to do with craftsmanship. There's a great tradition of craftsmanship. There's so many examples of products that tell fascinating stories, and at a time when I think people will be looking for something different, something more local. That's also an aspect, be it, you know, Greek silk or Greek shoes, Greek sandals. A lot of our companies are beginning to expand into markets beyond the Greek market. And of course, we have the additional advantage of having, in a normal year, more than 30 million people who visit Greece. So we want them to leave with memories, but also hopefully not necessarily buy a product, but when they're home, to buy, you know, products that remind them of their time in Greece until they come back.
We've talked about lots of positive things. For you, what are the sticky bits? Which are the bits that are difficult to get Greek people involved in this notion of renewal and of a new national brand? Is there a sense, you said earlier on, that people sometimes feel that they can't really kind of access the wealth and the opportunities here? Is it confidence again that, you know, you've got a great Greek wine, do export it, do go out to market? What are the bits that when you're talking to, you know, fellow Greeks and fellow Greek business leaders, that they still find a little bit of a pause before they take that next leap?
Well, this is a change management project at the grand scale, at the country scale. So it's not easy, I can tell you. And there are obstacles. Every day we bump into obstacles. But I think there's a real desire, fundamental desire, from the majority of Greeks to change. And you know this buzzword? Everyone talks about resilience. Well, we can show the world something about resilience. You know, we went through 10 years of extremely difficult period. Our democracy is stronger now. And our economy, I think, is going to come out stronger as a result of this crisis. So this is a story of renewal. But of course, there are sticking points, difficult nuts to crack. Education is a long-term project. Reform of the justice system is a long-term project. So not everything can be resolved with, you know, a piece of legislation. But we're fully aware of the fact that we essentially spent a year where we had to deal with crisis management while making sure we keep the reform momentum alive and kicking, because we want to make sure that once COVID is over, the foundations will be there to build back better, or I like the sort of phrase, or build something, maybe not build back better, but build something new in a better way, because we know we cannot go back to the old ways. This cannot be an economy that's focused on borrowing and consumption. And of course we've borrowed now, but every European country has borrowed, but we want to spend the money wisely. And what's interesting is that the market is giving us beyond the benefit of the doubt. We're borrowing at record low interest rates, and people are confident that this government is serious, and that it will maintain, once COVID is over, it will return to, you know, basic rules of fiscal discipline in the post-COVID world, which is going to be different. And I do expect fiscal rules to be more relaxed for quite some time, and that's the way it should be.
That was Greek Prime Minister Kyriakos Mitsotakis. The full interview is available in our February issue of Monocle, which is out now. You can also hear it as a special edition of The Chiefs, which will be broadcast tomorrow at 14:30 Athens time, 13:30 across Europe. You're listening to The Briefing on Monocle 24. And finally, we're heading back to London to get a roundup of the week's most interesting cultural stories. I'm very happy to say that our culture editor, Chiara Rimella, is standing by in London. Good afternoon, Chiara.
Good afternoon to you, Tyler.
So, you've always sort of served up an interesting list of topics to round out the week. You've got a bit of Australia there we could talk about. We can, of course, talk about the world of art. Maybe we should start in the world of art, because obviously so many topics we're looking at, and you know, if you heard the earlier interview when we were talking to our security correspondent Ben Otzog, you have this feeling that the world needs to be opening up, and of course, you know, many parts of the world are open up. I'm sure if people are up late, they're listening in Australia, New Zealand. Very different picture there. The world can't come in, and we can also look at even Brazil, maybe not handling the pandemic very well, but society open on many levels there as well. And then we've got all of these art fairs, which keep on getting kicked back. But some are going ahead.
Yeah, it's interesting this, Tyler, because, I think most relevantly, Basel recently announced that they're postponing their edition, which many hoped would happen in June, over to September. At the same time, you've got other smaller events, obviously Art Basel being the main on the calendar, but smaller events like Singapore Art Week going on right now. Today is the first kind of official day of the week. I think, as you mentioned, it is become something of a two-speed world, right? But the problem with Art Basel, for example, is that they're saying they're pushing it mainly to achieve the broadest possible attendance. So that goes back to your point about travelling mostly, because the problem with Basel not only is with, you know, the issue of the gathering itself, but mostly because they want to make sure that as many people as possible can come from abroad. And, you know, the problem with Singapore Art Week, for example, is that, yes, it is going ahead, but with huge restrictions on the amount of tourists that can come in. That's largely a very local event right now. So I think in the future, we're looking again for at least a few months to art fairs that might go ahead, but that will become more of a regional affair. You know, Art Basel in Hong Kong is still slated to go ahead in May, but what will that look like? Is that going to be a global fair or an Asian-only fair, considering that obviously the situation is very different between Europe and parts of Asia right now?
Chiara, just maybe changing tack a little bit, but it could almost be sort of an art installation story if we rewind the tapes a little bit and look back at those very, very early White House press briefings. We think of Sean Spicer being there. They, you know, you couldn't sometimes tell if you were watching Saturday Night Live or the real thing. This is it'll be fascinating to watch when the cameras and the lights, you know, flicker up again in the White House. This sort of this change of mood that we're going to move back to a world of proper press briefings, which we haven't seen for ages.
Incredible, yes. Like longing for a boring press conference is quite something. But yes, I think that's been the impression that people have gotten this week. You know, with the debut of Jen Psaki as the new person who will be delivering these briefings, and how she's been non-confrontational. She's taken questions from everyone in the audience, including Fox News. And I think that really opens up a lot of questions with regards also to what that spells for media in the US in general. You know, we've been so used to these extremes in covering the current political situation. We've talked a lot about the issue of echo chambers. What will that look like in the future if there is less of an approach, a confrontational approach towards what's called fake news? But at the same time, if people have gotten so used to a sort of kind of subscription model where they get their news just from the sources that they're used to getting them from, is there going to be a change in that? Or are we still going to stick with this habit that we've gotten into of getting the news just from the people who confirm our own bias? I think it's really interesting. And also, unfortunately, for all its ridiculousness, a lot of the time, you know, Trump did make for quite good ratings. And is the return of boring press conferences actually going to do a detriment to the ratings, or is it going to be a welcome return for many viewers as well?
Well, Kiara will certainly spend maybe the first 100 days monitoring that and probably be happy that there's a return to certainly a civil tone. Our culture editor in London, Kiara Rimella. That's all the time we have for this edition of The Briefing. Also, this week's editions of all of The Briefings. Our program was produced by Rhys James and Jolene Goffett. Our studio manager in London was Louis Allen, and here in Zurich, Desiree Bentley. The Briefing is back on Monday at the very same time. I will be back here in Zurich at Sunday, 10 o'clock, for, of course, our program. We'll be having a wonderful lineup of guests, also some Bloody Marys as well. I'm Tyler Riley. Have a good weekend. Goodbye.